Good afternoon, everyone. Good to be here. Every time I'm here, the seats are different. Last time I was over there, but I actually like this setup here. So we know that won't be that way next time, since I like it. You know how that works. Anyway, good to be here. And Penny and I will miss the potluck next week. I think we're in Birmingham next week. As far as the meatballs, I don't know which is the gluten-free, but I don't care. As long as they're meatballs and they're beef, I'll eat them. Okay, I appreciate the sermonette. It was a really good sermonette. I was thinking about this during the sermonette. We was talking about how all the food and so forth, and we decided to do a garden this year, and we were really excited about the garden. And we spent quite a bit of time in the garden. I know Penny would go out there every morning and check it, and two or three times a day. I've got to where I don't even look at it anymore because it's not doing real well. And I call it a dwarf garden because we've got these one plant that's supposed to be Roma tomatoes. I don't know whether they're really cherry tomatoes or that's just what they are. But our regular tomatoes, they look like at the best about the size of limes. That's the big ones, but it's been rather challenging. But we're going to have to make a few corrections, assuming we're able to do that next year. But we've enjoyed it, so much for that. I gave a sermon here in December that was a two-part sermon. Yeah, stop laughing. I never gave part two, did I? So what I'm going to do today. And you're thinking, oh, no. You're thinking, that's going to be long. But now what I'm going to do, I'm just going to take maybe, an hour or two to summarize the first part. Now, I'm going to take about 10 minutes to summarize the first part, and then we'll finish on time. But the title of the sermon was The Four Seasons of a Christian. And what I talked about, I talked about this piece, classical music piece by Antonio Vivaldi, which is called The Four Seasons. I remember Sue talked to me about it after church, remember, way back there in 2022. but I think it was in December of 2022. But what I found, and I thought this was interesting to me, is how the life of a Christian could sort of be compared to four seasons. And the piece, The Four Seasons, is actually four different pieces, but it's always played as one, and it goes spring, summer, fall, winter. So what I did the first time I gave this sermon, I talked about the first two seasons of a Christian. Now, what I thought I would do is turn to 1 Timothy chapter 1, just read a verse here to get us a bit oriented. And in 1 Timothy 1, verse 18, Apostle Paul is talking to Timothy, or writing to Timothy, and he says, verse 18 of 1 Timothy 1, says, "This charge I commit to you, son Timothy." So Timothy was a younger man. Who knows how old he was, because Paul was an older man by this time. I don't know exactly how old Paul was. He doesn't say, but I would assume he was at least in his 60s, maybe older than that, probably older than that. So Timothy, who knows? He was a younger elder, but he's trying to encourage him. And he said, "According to the prophecies previously made concerning you." So he had told Timothy things to be aware of. And he said, "That you may wage the good warfare." That you may wage the good warfare. Now what he's saying here is, the life of a Christian, it's not a sprint, it's a marathon. I mean, when you commit to God that you turn your life to be a Christian, whether you live a year or whether you live, 60, 70, 80 years, it's a period of time where hopefully, as a Christian, we learn letters, examples and some things to be aware of. But the point of the matter is, when we first become a Christian, there is what I would call the springtime of your life as a Christian. Now, I spent, quite a bit of time on that, but I remember back in high school listening to radio broadcasts and so forth about different religious ministers and so forth, and I started listening to the World Tomorrow broadcast, and I started seeing some things that I had never known, never really thought about, even though I'd grown up going to a Protestant church. I'd grown up I had a lot of good friends there. I had my aunts and uncles and cousins and so forth. Many of them went to the same church. But then I started seeing things. And at a point in my life, I was baptized. And that would be what I would call my first stage, or anyone who becomes a Christian, their first stage of their life as a Christian. And that is what I would call the spring. And that I wrote down, the time of learning to wait on the kingdom. The first part, spring, is learning to wait on the kingdom. What am I saying here? When you first, I would think in most cases, when you first start seeing things you didn't see, you didn't know, you didn't understand, and you start, I think I've told the story before about, I attended for a while, and I didn't know anything about the holy days. I knew about the Sabbath, and I knew about certain prophecies and so forth, but I remember sitting in services one day, and they were talking about this meal at the Feast of Trumpets. I had no idea what they're talking about. And I thought, how did I not know that? And I could tell you, take too long, but I could tell you about some other things that I didn't know about. But I was learning. But I was very enthusiastic. And I found that my family, I've never had a member of my family in the Church of God. I'm the only one that happens to be in there. And they were good people. I'm not trying to say I was really any better person than they are. But they were very moral. My mother and father are no longer alive, but my sister is, and she calls and talks about the Bible to Penny and I sometime. But learning to wait in the kingdom, it's a time of great enthusiasm, and you want to see the world converted, don't you? You want everybody to see what you see. And it's, but what we don't think about, and I won't turn there, but John 6, verse 44 says only God can call a person. Only God can open our minds. We can't just suddenly understand everything. I know I've gone back, I've read through the Bible many times. I don't even know how many, but I started again, starting just in Genesis and just reading each day, each morning when I get up, several pages, and it didn't take long. I'm already into Joshua. And it's amazing how quick you can go forward. But the point of the matter is, the springtime of the life of a Christian is learning to wait on the kingdom. Remember James and John, when they wanted to, and they were disciples, but they didn't understand everything. They were apostles of Jesus Christ, but they didn't understand everything. They saw somebody being offensive, and they wanted to call down fire from heaven to wipe out these people. That's crazy, isn't it? And Christ said, that's not what we need to do. We've been going to the Feast of Tabernacles my first time, and a couple of young men, single like myself at the time, we went together in the car, and I remember they talked and talked. I probably said this before. They talked and talked about all what they're going to get to eat and all the things they're going to do at the feast and the big steak, blah, blah, blah. And they lived like kings for 2 days, and then they ran out of second tithe. And they went to the pastor and asked for money, and he said no. So then I started hearing about how unfair he was. Well, if they had spent just a regular amount of money, now they came out okay. They didn't starve at the feast. Other people took care of them. But they didn't plan. Now, so what am I saying here? Enthusiasm is a good thing. It's a wonderful thing to understand the truth. I can't say enough how good it is. But the springtime, as we see these four seasons of our life as a Christian, is an exciting time, but it's only the beginning. It's only the beginning of the life of a Christian. So I spent quite a bit of time on that topic, but I just wanted to sort of summarize. Now, what's the second season? It's what I would call the summer. The summer of a Christian. So what would that be? Well, you've got the springtime where you're all enthused. You want everybody to know, and that's good. I wish everybody knew, but God hasn't called people. God hasn't opened people's minds at this time. I mean, how many people in the world even know of Christianity? I mean, people have all these weird religions, and how many people have made Christianity into something that's really not? All these idols and do's and don'ts of things that really the Bible doesn't say. But the second season is what I called finding the strength to serve. Finding the strength to serve. Now, if I could go, and I turned before, but I just was thinking about the time when Christ fed the 5,000 people. 5,000, I think it says men, and then you had men and women, and they didn't, all these people had been there. They've been hearing him preach. They've been seeing him heal people. They were all excited. And then it got later in the day, and it was time for somebody to have food. And Christ said to the disciples, the apostles, we need to get some food for these people. And one of them said, I can't remember how many fish, how many loaves of bread, but it was probably enough to not even feed a third of this room. And if I turn to the scripture, one of them said, we need to send them home. Just send them home. And Christ said, no, we're not sending them home. We're going to feed them. And it's like, well, how are we going to feed them? We don't have the food. And it was a miracle. Christ provided the food. But don't you know, over time, in your life as a Christian, whether you've been a Christian for, years and years and years, short time, whatever the case may be, there are times you get tired and you sort of like just leave, it's just send them away. Send people away. Let me be by myself. You ever feel that way in life, that you're tired? That you're tired? It doesn't mean you have to be, a senior citizen to be tired. I mean, when I was a kid, I thought 40 years old was ancient. I don't feel that way anymore. But yet, I know a man. I won't mention his name. You probably wouldn't know him. But he lives in Rome. He and his wife live in Rome, Georgia. And years ago, they didn't have a spokesman's club in Rome, but they had one in Birmingham. And he would drive twice a month on Wednesday night to Birmingham just to participate in spokesman's club. That's about a 2.5-hour drive. And he wasn't complaining about it. He was glad he got to do this. Now, there are a lot of things, some things you can do, some things we can't do, but yet you get tired. Think of all the youth activities. We drive and go places, and it would get tiring, but it doesn't mean you don't want to do it. It's just like you get a little tired, and you feel like, just leave me alone. I'm not saying this to you to leave me alone, but please leave me alone. No. Let's turn to Mark chapter 5. That was not in my notes. Mark chapter 5. A few verses here. And here's Christ in verse 21 of Mark 5. Now, this is an interesting situation because Jesus was healing people. He was... had to be the greatest preacher. It was God speaking. Can you imagine what a dynamic speaker he was? Verse 21 of Mark 5. Now when Jesus had crossed over again by the boat to the other side, a great multitude gathered to him. Don't you think he got tired of all these people pressing upon him? And give me this, give me that, I want this, and healing. But yet he kept doing it, didn't he? And he was by the sea. Behold, one of the rulers of the synagogue came, Jairus by name. He saw him, he fell at his feet, showing respect. And he begged him earnestly. Well, of course you would. If you knew somebody could heal your daughter, your husband, your wife, your friend, of course you would go to them. And this ruler begged him earnestly, please, my little daughter, she lies at the point of death. Come and lay your hands on her that she may be healed and she will live. Because this ruler could see that Jesus Christ had power. So Jesus went with him, and a great multitude, notice, they followed him and they thronged him, just pushing and pushing, and you know, everybody wanted to see, what's he going to do? Now, a certain woman, she had had a flow of blood for 12 years. Now, a certain one, and she had suffered many things from the physicians. So whoever she went to, they did not really know what they were doing to some degree. Maybe they did some, but not enough to heal her. So she had spent all that she had. But she wasn't getting any better, but she was getting worse. So when she heard about Jesus, she came behind him in the crowd, and she touched his garment. And when she did this, she said to herself, I guess, if only I could just touch his clothes, I'll be made well. Immediately, the fountain of blood was dried up, and she felt in her body that she was healed of this affliction. And Jesus, immediately knowing in himself the power that had gone out of him, he turned around to the crowd and said, who touched my clothes? But his disciples said to him, you see these people, this multitude thronging you? How in the world do you say, who touched me? Now, again, Jesus Christ was happy to heal, of course. But don't you think he got tired of all the, not only the people thronging him, but the people belittling him to the point, you know, of course he initially, eventually I should say, was crucified. Now, there was a, a composer named Johann Sebastian Bach, one of the famous composers in the Baroque era back in the 1700s. He was one of the greater musicians of all times. He wrote hundreds, maybe even thousands of musical pieces. And he was in a position, composer for the emperor. But much of what Bach, who's, like I said, one of the more famous composers in the world, much of it's lost. And the reason it's lost, he would wrap his fish and meat in paper, and the paper were the paper he wrote a lot of his pieces on. So a lot of what Bach wrote has been just basically, we'll never see. There's a famous piece by Frederick Schubert, I should say, who they found it years after he died, and it was in three movements, which most symphonies are, but they only found the first two movements, and it's called the Unfinished Symphony. It's his Symphony Number 8, and quite frankly, it's probably one of my favorite symphonies. I always think, man, I wish we had the other two movements. But one thing Bach did, he dedicated almost all his music, both sacred and secular, to God. And and whenever he wrote a manuscript, he would always put two initials down. He would put JJ, and he would also put SDG. Now, the JJ stood for, well, in English, it would be translated, Jesus, help me. And the other part, the SDG, would stand for, to God alone be the glory. Now, so we could do worse than assign the words of our everyday life of Jesus, help me, and to God be the glory. We could do worse, could we not? So when we enter the time of the summer of the life of a Christian, it's easy to get tired. It's easy to feel like, well, the initial enthusiasm's off, send them away, I'm tired, but yet, yeah, of course we need to pace ourselves. Of course we need to maybe slow down in certain areas, but it doesn't mean it's a time to say, send them away or leave me alone. It's a time in the life of a Christian where we are asked to keep finding the strength to serve, to keep finding the strength to serve. So, what we've had, just in summary, spring, learning to wait in the kingdom, summer, finding the strength to serve. So what would I call the third season of a Christian's life? And I would call that the fall the fall, you know, spring, summer, fall. And I've entitled this, Accepting Our Failures. Accepting Our Failures. You know, we're not, I heard a sermonette this morning. I was listening to one of my former congregations online, and I was listening. There was a sermonette, and the gentleman that gave the sermonette was talking about how, in one sense, you need to not forgive yourself for your past, because things that you know you're doing wrong, you got to stop. In another sense, you have to forgive yourself for the past of items and things that you've repented of, because God doesn't hold things that you've repented of in the past and keep dredging it up. But yet, we need to learn to be able to accept our failures, and we all have areas in our life that we look at and say, we could have done better about that. Matthew 14. Peter. Peter was very brash. Hey, he was a good... He's a good person in many, many ways, but he's quite brash. And he sometimes, I'm sure, Jesus Christ got a little tired of hearing some of the things that Peter would say, because he's very brash. Now, here's Peter walking. We see Jesus walking on the sea. It began in verse 22. Well, what happened before Jesus walked on the sea? Well, if you turn back, right before that, two things happened that we see right here. Number one, he fed the 5,000 that we just talked about a little bit. Before that, John the Baptist was beheaded. John the Baptist was beheaded. You know, I gave a sermon last week in a congregation where I was. Actually, we were in Albany, New York. Now, I don't used to go to Albany, New York. Don't ask me how we got there, but I'm John the Baptist. So John the Baptist died. And notice at verse 13, I'm going to turn back to verse 25 in a minute, but in verse 13, when Jesus heard that John the Baptist had died, he had been beheaded, he departed there from by boat to a deserted place by himself. He wanted to get a grip. John the Baptist was his friend. He was the lead. He set the pace. He was the one that, I guess you could say, the main event in people's lives. And then he had the courage, the strength to move away when Jesus Christ took charge. But Jesus went to a deserted place by himself. I'm sure he just wanted to get a grip on what had just happened. But when the multitudes heard it, they followed him on foot. They followed him on foot from the cities. And when Jesus went out and saw a great multitude, all these people, and it sort of fits in with the section we just looked at about finding the strength to serve, to keep going the summer of a Christian's life. But he was moved to compassion. He kept healing the sick. And then he fed the 5,000. Then, a few verses later, over in chapter 15, where we were, verse 25, we see Jesus walking on the water, beginning in verse 22. But looking down at verse 25 of Matthew 14, in the fourth watch of the night, Jesus went to them. He was walking on the sea, and his disciples saw it. They saw him walking on the sea, and they were troubled. And they said, "This is a ghost." And they cried out for fear. "What in the world is this?" is what they were thinking. But immediately, now think about this. They were in this boat. Here is Jesus, who they hadn't totally comprehended all the magnitude of who he was, that he was God, the Son of God. He said, "Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid." But Peter, he answered him and said, If it's you, Lord, command me to come to you on the water. And Jesus said, "Well, come on." And when Peter got down out of the boat, he walked on the water to Jesus. And when he saw that the wind was boisterous, he was afraid. And he began to sink, and he cried out, Lord, save me. And Jesus immediately stretched out his hand, caught him, and said, oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt? Now, it's easy to look at this and say, why did Peter doubt? Peter walked on water. Takes a lot of faith. But he got afraid because he was human, just like we're human. And Peter, in the end, learn to accept his failures. And I could give you a whole sermon on Peter. And Peter did a lot of good things. He did some foolish things. But Peter walked in water. Ooh, that was something. Now look at Luke 22. One more little thing about Peter that I've always found quite interesting. Now, I could go back and I could talk and I could read where Peter said, oh, man, if everybody deserts you, Jesus, I'll never desert you. I'll always be there. I'll always be there beside you. And quite frankly, you know, when they went out after the Passover, that night they went out and the throngs came and Peter took his sword and cut off the ear of one of the servants. Probably not aiming for the ear, but and Peter healed him. I mean, Peter didn't heal him. Jesus healed him. And Peter was so strong. But then they arrested Jesus. And they took Jesus. They took him away. And Peter followed. In fact, look at verse 54 of Luke 22. The man who just a few hours later told Jesus, no matter what happens, I'll never leave you. No matter what happens, I'm there. I'll be there to the finish. Well, Peter was about to fail. And yet, notice what happened. Verse 54. Then having arrested him, so Christ was arrested, they led Christ, they brought him into the high priest's house. But notice, Peter now followed at a distance. He wasn't right up there with him. He was getting a little nervous here about the situation. He followed at a distance. Now when they had kindled a fire in the midst of the courtyard and sat down together, Peter sat down among them. He wasn't right there next to Jesus who was arrested, but he was wanting to know what was going on. He still felt he could probably do something. Well, a servant girl saw him by the fire, and she looked intently at him and said, hey, this man was also with him. I saw him there too when Jesus was arrested. But Peter denied it, and he said, woman, I don't even know him. That's kind of a failure, isn't it? I don't even know who this man who he said he would die for. Well, after a little while, another saw him and said, you are one of them. Peter said, man, I am not. Then about an hour had passed. Another confidently said, surely this fellow was also with him, for he's a Galilean. You know, how did they know? His accent was different. Like when Penny and I were in New York, people kind of knew we weren't from New York. Especially Penny. but I'll have a rough night for saying that. But you know, it was like they had a different accent. Well, you know, what happened, and I could turn over to another scripture where it says Peter even started cursing. Look at verse 61. The Lord turned and looked at Peter. And Peter remembered the word of the Lord where he had said, you're going to deny me three times before the rooster crows. And what happened? Peter went out and he wept bitterly. He knew he had not come through. Peter, you know, in a sense, he was a failure at that particular time. But Jesus didn't see him as a failure. But Peter just felt like it was all over for him. In the life of a Christian, we often reach a point where you feel like you're stuck yourself as a person, like you're not making movement. Sure, we've all gone through periods like that. And it can be a time of doubt. It can even be a time of fear. It can be a time of giving up. You know, I could turn to the parable of the sower, and there are those that just, after quite a long time, just give up. Say, I'm not cut out for this. I've seen numerous, you know, I've been an elder for over 30 years. I've been was a pastor for over 10 years, an employed pastor, and I've seen numerous Christians, good people, over time, just pack it in and say, I don't think I'm cut out for this life of a Christian. But God doesn't want us to feel that way. God didn't, and Jesus Christ and God the Father, they didn't say, Peter, you're a failure. We don't want you. No, no. Peter needed to see that, yes, he had failed in that particular thing, but God didn't see him as a failure. So as our fall as a Christian, we need to realize we're going to make mistakes sometimes. And we're not going to do as well as we like. Now, that doesn't mean that's good. I wish I never made a mistake. But yet we do. We're human. And God, the Father, and Jesus Christ, they don't just turn away and say, I don't want them. They made a mistake. They want us to accept our failures and move on and improve areas where we can. Look at John chapter 21. Here's the end of the story, in a sense, for this time, for Peter. Of course, there's a lot more in the Bible about Peter. He even wrote two letters, which are very encouraging letters. But here is when God wants us to see where we've messed up and where we can improve as a person. So they, you know, Peter went fishing, those disciples went fishing, and Jesus showed up, you know, the resurrected Christ, however form he was in. You know, I don't know all the, you can't really say everything, but he was no longer flesh and blood human being, but he appeared to Peter. I can't really explain it all. But in verse 15 of John 21, the cook sat down and they had breakfast. And when they had eaten breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me more than these? Now remember, Peter told him how much he loved him, didn't he? And now Jesus, the resurrected Christ, says, how much do you love me, Peter? And he said, well, yes, Lord, you know I love you. And Peter did love Jesus, but yet he made some mistakes. And Jesus said, feed my lambs. And then he said to him a second time, Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me? And he said again, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. And Peter said, Jesus said, tend my sheep then. And then, verse 17, then he said a third time. Now, how many times did Peter deny Jesus? Three, didn't he? And now Peter had to have seen the relevance of what Christ was asking him. He's asking him a third time, does he love him? And three times Peter had denied him, but yet he didn't quit loving him. Peter loved Jesus. He just felt like he was a failure. Jesus didn't quit loving Peter. And the third time he said, Simon, Jonah, do you love me? Peter was grieved because he said this to the third time. I'm sure all kind of things were flashing through his mind. And he said, Lord, you know all things. You know I love you. And Jesus again said, feed my sheep. Now he goes on to tell Peter he's going to be martyred for the faith. Peter was discouraged. He felt basically lost, I guess you could say, but Jesus pointed him back in the proper direction. He told him to feed his sheep. And if we really love God, we will not give up. We'll accept our failures and work a lifelong process, isn't it? Rick Beam, one of my favorite people, one of my best friends, told me once the most important thing a minister can do is love the brethren. Now, none of us do it as well as we could, but I remember Rick telling me, I've had many talks with Rick, and he said, you need to love the brethren, and we need to learn to accept where we stumble and move on. So you've got the spring, summer, fall, and what is the winter time? It's looking forward to God. Looking forward to God. I wrote down here, an old retiree had some calling cards printed up to go with his new status in life. In the center, they had his name. This particular man's name was Joe Banks. So right in the center of this little card said Joe Banks. But on the four corners, you know, just sort of like the four seasons, I guess you could say, on the four corners in small print were four pieces of information. Number one, it said no business. Number two, it said no address. Number three, it said no phone. Number four, it said no money. As he retired, I remember John Elliott. I was talking to him once, and he had retired, and I'd just retired, you know, on the as far as employed. And John said, "What do you think about retirement?" And I said, "Well, basically, I mean, I look at myself. I want to serve, and Penny wants to serve in any way we can in the various congregations, and I'm supposed to coordinate the Lake Geneva Feast Site. I'm on what they call the Member Appeal Committee. I'm on the another committee that I won't mention the name of that, and then I'm on the the Prophecy Committee. We'll go look at papers." But I told John, I said, "The only difference I see is I don't get paid." John said, "That's what I think too." But, you know, we're happy. You want to serve. I mean, I work a couple days a week at a hospital in Decatur, but you want to serve because our life is, it just goes on. And you and I, Christians, want to be in the resurrection, don't we? The first resurrection. So does a Christian ever retire? Well, you know, we slow down. As you get older, you have to slow down. Yet, you don't quit living your life as a Christian. It's just a different phase in your Christian journey. 2 Timothy, as we head into the home stretch here. 2 Timothy chapter 4. Last letter that Paul wrote. The very last letter Paul wrote, right before he was to be executed by the emperor. In chapter 4, verse 7 and 8. In fact, I'll read verse 6, 7, and 8. Verse 6 says, "I'm already being poured out like a drink offering, and the time of my departure is at hand." Paul knew he was about to die. Not a natural death either. A death where the emperor was going to have him executed. But notice what Paul said. "I have fought the good fight. I finished the race." But he wasn't completely finished, but he knew his race as a Christian was about to end. And he was about to go to rest in the grave until Christ returns and he is resurrected at the first resurrection. And he says, "I've kept the faith." Paul said, "I never gave up." Then he says, "Finally, there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will give me on that day." But he doesn't finish there. Notice the rest of the verse. "And not only me," he said, "but also all those who love his appearing." Paul is saying he's just one of a large group that will be resurrected from the grave when Christ returns. Can you imagine the Apostle Paul ever completely retiring? Of course not. No, of course not. We never go into retirement as a Christian. It's just a different phase, and I said I've called it learning to wait on God of the return of Jesus Christ. Now, the Apostle John, I'll wrap this up here in a minute. The Apostle John, you know, he was the last, he's probably the only apostle that wasn't martyred. And the Apostle John, he had to have thought, you know, all his friends were gone. And he was still out there, and he was sent away. It looks like he was arrested. He was sent to what was called the Isle of Patmos. In Revelation, let's turn to the book of Revelation, because the Apostle John wrote the book of Revelation right toward the end of his life. You know, he wrote the Gospel of John. He wrote 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, and he wrote Revelation. And he wrote what God, what the angel told him to write. And verse 1 of Revelation 1 says it's the revelation of Jesus Christ. So Jesus Christ is doing the revealing. John just wrote it down. Which God gave him to show his servants things which must shortly take place. And he sent and he signified by his angel to his servant John. So God sent an angel to John. And he was on this Isle of Patmos, who bore witness to the word of God and to the testimony of Jesus Christ and all things that he saw. And he says, blessed is he and she, person, who reads and those who hear the words of this prophecy and keep those things that are written in it. For the time is near. So obviously John thought, the time is near. But you know, that was only 2,000 years ago. And what does God say? A year to God is like a thousand years to God is like a day. There's two places it says that in the Bible. So John received this revelation. He wrote it all down. It's all in the book of Revelation. But let me just read verse 9 through 12 of this. It says, I, John, both your brother and companion in tribulation, and in the kingdom of patience of Jesus Christ, I was on the island that was called Patmos for the word of God and for the testimony of Jesus Christ. So I guess he was in prison there is what it appears. So I was in the Spirit on the Lord's day. You know, the day of Christ, the period of Christ returning. And I heard behind me a loud voice as of a trumpet. And this voice said, I'm the Alpha, I'm the Omega, I'm the first, I'm the last. What you see, John, write it in a book and send it to the seven churches which are in Asia, which are Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamos, Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia, Laodicea. And John said, then I turned to see the voice that spoke with me. And having turned, I saw seven golden lampstands. And in the midst of the seven lampstands, one like the Son of Man. Then it describes what he saw. Do you not think John probably thought his active service was over? But no, God still had more in store for John to write this book, the book of Revelation. Paul in prison wrote about his faith. Here's John on the Isle of Patmos writing what God told him to write. Now let's turn final scripture here over to Philippians. Philippians chapter 3. Apostle Paul wrote this. He was in prison when he wrote this. Now I don't know if he was in prison in Rome or Caesarea. Explanations here, but Paul was in prison more than once. But he was in prison when he wrote Philippians. He was in prison when he wrote Ephesians. He was in prison when he wrote Colossians. And it was another period of time when he wrote 1st and 2nd Timothy. But here is Paul writing to the Philippian church, a church that didn't have a lot of money, a church that didn't have a lot of power. It wasn't a wealthy church. It wasn't an impressive church as far as numbers or money, but God, through Paul, certainly loved the Philippian church. And in chapter 1 of Philippians, I want to read just a few verses here. As I finish this sermon and I look at our final phase of life of a Christian, what you call the winter, looking forward to God. Verse 6, notice, Paul said, being confident of this very thing, that he, God, who began a good work in you, Philippian church, he will complete it until the day of Jesus Christ when Christ returns. Notice what he says to the Philippian church. Just it is right for me to think this of you all, because I have you in my heart. Paul loved these people. inasmuch as both in my chains, he was in prison, and in the defense and confirmation of the gospel, you are all partakers with me of grace. God's grace encompasses all. For God is my witness, Paul said, how greatly I long for you all with the affection of Jesus Christ. And this I pray, said Paul, that your love may abound still more and more in knowledge and in all discernment. He wanted these men and women, Christians, to use common sense and to grow and to help each other. That you may approve the things that are excellent, that you may be sincere and without offense until the day of Christ, Christ returns. Being filled with the fruits of righteousness, which are by Jesus Christ to the glory and the praise of God. He wanted the Philippian church to stay strong. He wasn't worried about how much money they had or how much prestige they had. Now, when I was a young boy, I used to go fishing with my grandparents, and, you know, I think my grandfather died when I was 12 or 13. But I loved going fishing with them. My grandmother didn't die until later. I remember, this is totally off the subject, but I remember my grandmother was in a nursing home, and she was 92 years old. And I remember going to visit her one time in that nursing home, and she was talking about the young girl down the hall. And I thought, they have young girls in here? Well, the young girl was 89. So my grandmother thought, that young girl down the hall. You know, but I always thought that was humorous. But it had nothing to do with the sermon, but I said it anyway. But anyway, I used to go fishing with my grandparents. I loved it. Man, they would bait my hook. They would help whenever the fish we caught, they'd take the fish. It was some of the most enjoyable time I ever spent. Well, in the end, what does a Christian have to say? And I put something down here that I was thinking about. It's like a boy and an old man sitting on the dock late in the afternoon fishing. And so it's a comparison I was thinking about. I wrote down, they talked about many things. They talked about why sunsets are red. They talked about why the rain falls. They talked about why the seasons change. They talked about what life is like. You know, as a young boy talking to his grandfather. Finally, the boy looked up at the old man as the old man was baiting his hook for him. And he asked his grandfather, does anyone ever see God, Granddaddy? And the old man looked across the blue waters, looked at his grandson and said, son, it's getting so I hardly see anything else. Because he was longing to be in the kingdom of God. So the life of a Christian could be compared to the seasons. You know, you've got the springtime when you're all enthusiastic, and then you've got the summer, finding the strength to serve. You've got the fall, accepting your failures. But in the end, we just look for the return of God.